For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Yeah, so we're rounding the corner. We're getting toward the end of the Gospel of Luke. And you know, there are questions that I think pretty much everybody has when it comes to the God of the Bible. I know I had questions like this. You know, you get this idea of God's judgment. You know, why does God judge? You know, how can God be loving and send people to hell? I remember having many conversations with Christians along these lines before I became a Christian myself, because I was wrestling with this idea of the finality of this judgment that the Bible talks about, and comparing it with this idea of, you know, that God is loving and compassionate and merciful and slow to anger, but yet he will condemn people. And I was willing to accept that. I understand that there are people who do evil things, and there are really evil people, but it's hard to imagine that there's anyone that's so evil that they would deserve eternity in judgment, an irredeemable place. And so we wrestle with these things because the scriptures talk about these things. And we see this picture of God as both a loving father and a wrathful judge. Would a loving God even create a hell? How are we to think about this? How are we to understand? And probably the bigger question, what right does God have to tell me how to live my life? That question right there keeps many of us from ever believing in him. This was probably my personal biggest hang-up is, why would you create me, God, with the ability and the capacity to choose? People say I'm stubborn and I'm willful. Well, why would you make me this way and then judge me for being stubborn and willful with you? I remember having a conversation with a Christian who was working really hard, because I was a non-Christian dating her Christian daughter. And, she was like, you know, working really hard to help me see these things. And I just remember being like, you know, I'm open to the idea that God exists. You know, I don't have a problem with that. But if God has a problem with me and God created with me, then isn't God's problem with himself? Why would he create a being the way that he created me and then be like, you're bad? And she was like, oh, Lord, help me. You know? Who does the God of the Bible think he is? That's a question we all wrestle with. Who is this who says that they have the right to speak to us about how we should live, that they have the right to critique us, or even the right to judge us? And this is an issue of perspective. This is an issue of understanding our place in the universe and God's place in the universe, and the way those two important realities, those important truths, fit together. The context for this passage that we're reading this morning is this is the last week before Jesus' crucifixion. And so he knows that he is going to die for the sins of mankind. The threat of the beatings, of the abuse, of the public shame, of the pain of the crucifixion, that was all bad. But Jesus was aware that there was something much worse. The worst thing, the most terrible thing that anyone could ever undergo was right around the corner for him. He was going to take the judgment of God, the wrath of his Father, for all the sins of mankind upon himself. Next to that, a cross would pale in comparison. And so he spends this last week concentrating his teachings on the things that matter most. And he gets away, he kind of cuts away the trappings and the filler, and he gets right down to the direct important issues that were needed to be understood in order to accomplish his mission. And so he's in Jerusalem during the Passover, and the kid gloves are off. He's having these really hard conversations, these really hard teachings. And Luke 19, we studied 2 weeks ago, he entered into Jerusalem and they hailed him as a conquering king. People were saying, Hosanna, the Messiah is here. Yet 1 week later, they'd be crying out, crucify, crucify. What happened from the triumphal entry to the crucifixion that turned people against him in such a vicious way? Well, it's teachings like the one we're going to study this morning. The first thing he does when he rolls into town is he goes to the temple where the money changers are. Now see, what had happened was an elaborate business had developed around the worship of God in the temple. The temple was supposed to be a house of prayer, a place where people came to communicate with God, to worship God, and to celebrate who God is and the community that God had put them in. But these religious rulers had found a way to make a considerable amount of money, because Roman currency had Roman icons on them, pictures of Caesar. And if you were going to give money to the temple, it would be a sin in their eyes and their thinking to use Roman money to give to God. So you had to have your money changed into an appropriate Jewish currency so that you could give temple money to the temple. And of course, there was an exorbitant exchange rate. And so these guys were getting rich off of people's faith desire to pray and draw near to God. And Jesus is like, no way. This was analogous to a lot of the televangelists we see on TV who are praying on the poor, promising them more wealth if they send in their money, promising them healing if they put their hands on the television and send in a certain dollar amount. Those guys are alive and well today, and they were alive and well in Jesus' day. And when the Son of God, God incarnate, comes to earth to dwell among us, what does he do? He shows up, he flips over their tables, he grabs a whip off the wall, and he drives them out of the temple, saying, how dare you? My Father's house is a house of prayer. An awesome picture. How some of us would love to do that today. Because God was being misrepresented to his people, as is so often the case in American culture, with the types and forms of Christianity we see on television. And so Jesus is not making friends, especially with the religious rulers. And so the religious authorities, at the beginning of Luke 20, they start trying to devise ways of trapping Jesus, of discrediting him in front of the eyes of the people. And it's always a bad idea to try to outsmart God. It's just bad. And so, you know, they're trying to be clever, and they are actually quite clever in the ways they start asking him questions that are kind of setting him up, that like there's no right answer, and he's either going to get in trouble with Rome or he's going to get in trouble with the people, depending on how he answers. And he outsmarts them every time and turns it back on them and shows the brilliance of God and how man just can't even hold a candle to it. But the passage we're looking at this morning is the parable of the vineyard. And it is a passage that is to the religious rulers as a response. They've asked this question, by what authority do you do these things? What gives you the right, Jesus? You haven't been ordained. You haven't been to seminary. You haven't been approved by us as a teacher. Where does your authority come from that you think you can critique us and tell us what God really wants? Because he's been disrupting their religious system. He's been attacking their source of income, their social and political power. He has become a threat to the religious rulers, and they want to know, what gives you the right to speak to us this way and to tell the people that we're falsely representing God? And so Jesus says, well, let me tell you a story. And Luke 20, verse 9, he starts, and it says, he began to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard and rented it out to vine growers and went on a journey for a long time. At the harvest time, he sent a slave to the vine growers so they would give him some of the produce of the vineyard. But the vine growers beat him and sent him away empty-handed. So what he's describing here in the cultural context is essentially sharecropping, a common occurrence in that day, where a landowner might set everything up, have everything put in place, and then lease out his land to people who would then work the land, and then the owner of the land would get his cut. Usually a third or half of the, it would be wine in this case, that was produced by this vineyard, would go to the landowner, and then the workers would keep their part. And so the landowner sends a representative to collect his cut because it's his land. He has fronted all the money and the expense and owns all the equipment and land being used, but the laborers refuse and beat up his representative and send him home. And so it helps us to think about who these characters represent. And this is one that would have been very familiar. The Jewish audience, the Israelites hearing this, would have known immediately who all the characters were because of the symbolism that's being used. The vineyard is a long-standing symbol for the nation of Israel. And so when Jesus selects a vineyard in this parable, he's making it clear that what he's talking about is God's relationship to the people. God owns the land. He owns Israel. And he has, from his perspective, lent it to them. And we know this because of passages like this. In Isaiah 5, a very famous and well-known passage to the Israeli people, God says in verse 1, "Let me sing now for my well-beloved a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill. He dug it all around, removed its stones, planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in the middle of it, and he also hewed out a wine vat in it. Then he expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only worthless ones. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there for me to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? Why, when I expected it to produce good grapes, did it produce worthless ones? So now let me tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge and it will be consumed. I will break down its walls and it will become trampled ground. I will lay waste to it. It will not be pruned or hoed, but briars and thorns will come up. I will also charge the clouds to rain no rain on it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his delightful plant. Thus he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, a cry of distress." And so the context for this is God is like, I have brought you guys together. I have pruned you. I have taken care of you. I have given you everything that you need to become the people that you were created to be, to create a society of love and justice and mercy, and to create a nation that would be a beacon of light in a dark world where people live selfishly and they murder and destroy each other. And even though I've given you all of this and I've protected you from your enemies and I've given you my word and my prophets, you have become just like them. And so I will not protect you. I will let your enemies consume you. Even though I love you, I expect that you will respond and help me and my purposes to reach the rest of the world with my love and my truth. And so this whole idea of Israel as a vineyard was very well known, and it's exactly what Jesus is referring to here. There are many others as well. In Psalm 80, Hosea 10:1, Israel is used as a vine or a vineyard, a very common symbol to them. And so when Jesus starts talking to them about this vineyard, it's clear to them that he's talking about them. It's also obvious that the vineyard owner is God. He's the one who created everything. The tenants then, who are refusing to give the owner his cut, are the people of Israel. And those sent by the owner, sent by God to the people, are the prophets. And there's a long history of prophets that have been sent by God in Israel to bring them back on the path to God. to bring them back on the path of love and truth and justice and mercy. And more often than not, they beat up, abused, and often killed these prophets, just like the tenants beat up the representatives sent by the vineyard owner. And so the story goes on in 11. And so the owner proceeded to send another slave, and they beat him also and treated him shamefully and sent him away empty-handed. And he proceeded to send a third, and this one also they wounded and cast out. And the owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do? I will send my beloved son. Perhaps they will respect him." But when the vine growers saw the son, they reasoned with one another, "This is the heir. Let us kill him so that the inheritance will be ours." So they threw him out of the vineyard and they killed him. This is a parable of God's perspective, not just on Israel, but the entire human condition. That's what we need to see. You know, we're so used to seeing this issue of who is God and who does God think he is from our perspective. But this parable does a brilliant job of helping us to see this whole condition from God's perspective. And we need to pray, we need to ask that God will open the eyes of our heart and help us to understand the reality that's being spoken of from his perspective. Remember our questions from earlier. Why does God judge? How can God be a loving God and send people to hell? Would a loving God even create hell? And what right does God have to tell me how to live my life? Who does this God of the Bible think he is? The answer's right here. He thinks he's God. He thinks he's the creator of all things, the owner of the vineyard, the one who is responsible for the creation of all life and all matter and all energy. John 1:3-5, all things came into being through him. Apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. I don't know how more clear you could be than that. In him was life, and the life was the light of men, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. He's the owner. He made it. He made it all. He made the world. He made the universe. He made your body, and he owns your soul. I can hardly even say that without my body just going, "No!" You know? My soul is not my own. I don't know if it's that I'm an American and, you know, I'm such an individualist or what, but I mean, there's nothing that's mine. That word mine is an illusion according to the Bible. There is no mine. There's only his. How amazingly he's generous and he's wonderful and he gives us great things, but that we belong to him. He's the vineyard owner. We're just the stewards. We're just the caretakers who have it on rent. And it includes everything. What right does God have? He's the owner. We are not God. We don't own ourselves. We are not the masters of our own destiny. We are fearfully and wonderfully made, knit together in our mother's womb for a noble purpose. We're fantastic creatures, so fantastic that God's willing to die for us so that we can be redeemed and be reconciled into a relationship with him. But we still are not God and never will be God. There is only one God, one owner and creator and king. And it's not you and it's not me, it's him. Who does this God think he is? He thinks he's the creator of all things and the owner of the universe. Now, he created us for this divine purpose of love and truth and community. The good news is he didn't just create us so like he could be like a kid with a magnifying glass burning ants just to watch us burn. He created us magnificently for a noble purpose. What more noble thing is there than love? And God says, if you want to use one word to define who I am, it's love. I created you for relationship. Relationship with him, relationship with each other. that we would bring more love into the universe. But how do we use these things that God has given us? What do we do with these bodies, with these souls, with these minds, with these amazing gifts that God has given us? We use them selfishly. We use them to destroy each other, to rape each other, to murder each other. We destroy God's planet, make a complete mess of ourselves, live in a world where there is little, if any, justice, little, if any, love or compassion. People are abused, used, and thrown away. And here we are, and the wealthiest nation in the world, the most privileged people there are. But every one of us has a story, a deep, compelling, and powerful story of the pain that we, even we, cannot avoid because we live in a broken world. We've been betrayed. We've been abused. We've been alone. We've been downtrodden. And it is man's fault because man thought he could be his own God. And we've made a mess of it. We've taken God's great and noble and beautiful and wonderful gifts and used them to make this. And from a perfect God's perspective, we must understand that he is not happy with the result. So he sent his son, and we killed him too. We mocked him, we beat him, we falsely accused him, we threw him up on a cross, the most painful physical death we could imagine. And create with all the creativity God has given us. We've used it to figure out how to do terrible things to each other, like crucifixion and worse. And this is what we do with what God has given us. Who is God? Why does God judge? He is a father with a murdered son. I think about that. You know, I start thinking about, why would God judge? And, you know, why are there people that need to be judged? And then I think about what I would do if someone killed my son. Think about that. I'm not even close to being an all-powerful being, but I don't care. I mean, when I think about what would go on in my heart, and how could I have mercy if I sent my son, like this vineyard owner, to claim what was legally and rightfully and goodly ours, and someone murdered him to try to take his inheritance away, what would you do if it were you? What kind of wrath might you have for the people who did that? But God's so much better than us. He doesn't want us destroyed, even though that's exactly what we've done. He doesn't want to see us destroyed. Jesus, hanging from the cross, Luke 23:34, cries out to the Father, saying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they are doing. Who does that? We're not dealing with people. We're dealing with something that's so much greater than ourselves, that has such a capacity for love and forgiveness and compassion and mercy, that none of us, you or I, can even begin to approach this. This statement here, with my son were being murdered, and in the middle of it cried out to me, forgive them, that would just enrage me all the more, frankly. She's so good. I'm really going to kill you now. John 3:16-21 says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but shall have eternal life. For God did not send the son into the world to judge the world, but that the world might be saved through him. He who believes in him is not judged. He who does not believe has been judged already, because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten son of God. This is the judgment. that the light has come into the world, and men loved the darkness rather than the light, for their deeds were evil. For everyone who does evil hates the light and does not come to the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But he who practices truth comes to the light so that his deeds may be manifested as having been wrought in God. Now, I don't know about you, but I have never seen a more accurate description of my heart. Because I know, I knew as a non-believer, and I know it even more now, almost 20 years later, I know that there is darkness there, that there is evil there, and that there's a part of me that wants to hide. It wants to hide from me. It wants to hide from you. It wants to live in the dark. And it doesn't want to be exposed. And it is wicked and it is evil. And it runs from God. And it runs from the idea that there is a greater thing than myself that has a right to talk to me and to tell me and to show me how to live. And the idea that I can be forgiven despite that darkness that lives in my own heart, that I could be given a free gift of forgiveness, that Jesus, knowing this about me, would go to the cross and die for my sins, just like he went to the cross to die for your sins, is super compelling evidence to me that we are not dealing with human thinking. There's no other religion like this. There's no religion in the world other than biblical Christianity that teaches that, in fact, it's God who jumps through the hoops to clear the way for us so that we can receive his forgiveness as a free gift. Any other religion you study talks about jumping through hoops, obeying the rules, working really hard, and hopefully making it. That sounds like what man would make up, because that's how we relate to each other. But this idea of love and compassion and truth and mercy upon mercy, and a God who's that good, who's better than any of us, not just more powerful, but a better person, who can love that much, who can forgive that much. It answers a lot of the questions I have. And it creates a picture of something that I would long to be. I would long to be a father who could forgive. Really forgive and really love at that level. And God promises that that's his plan. That he wants to replicate within us these incredible, noble, unbelievably loving qualities that he possesses. Now, God could have just wiped us out. That's what I would have done if I were God. I wouldn't have waited for Jesus. I would have wiped this out long ago. And he's, because he owns us, because he is the creator, he can do whatever he wants with it. The potter working at the potter's wheel will form a vessel and he can mash it up and change it into something else anytime he wants. And that's what we are in comparison to God. We are his vessels. His jars of clay that he's working and forming into the shapes that he desires. We are a rebellious lot who keep veering off in our own directions. And he could have just said, you know, I'm just going to start over. This is just obviously headed in the wrong direction. But he decides not to do that. He decides to continue to send his representatives, his prophets. He continues to send people in your life, in my life, to help us to understand his will, to draw us towards him. He gives us mercy after mercy. He gives us many chances. And yet many of us continue to reject his forgiveness and pretend like we don't deserve to be judged. And we keep crying out, who does God think he is? Who does this God of the Bible think he is that he can tell me how to live? Think about the tenants in this story. Think about how crazy they are. They don't own this land. They're only there because of the investment that the landowner made. And when they send a son, they think, hey, if we kill him, maybe we'll inherit this. How crazy is that? Like the father's going to be like, well, I don't have an heir. I might as well leave it to you now. That's insane, isn't it? You know what else is insane? The way that we treat God. And when we stand at Him and say, who do you think you are? I'm my own God. We're just like these guys. This parable is so perfect. God is so brilliant in helping us see, what does it look like? What does our rebellion look like from God's perspective? It looks like this. Now, I'm sure the tenants didn't see it that way. They saw it as, well, we did all the work. You know, what about us and what we deserve? And how dare he think he deserves a cut? Which is exactly what many of us think about God. I am my own man. I make my own way in this life. I make my choices. I do what I decide is right for me. No, you don't. There's nothing you have that you haven't been given. It's all on loan. It's not yours. It's not mine. And this is a deep and hard truth. But it's so important that we realize it. So Jesus is bringing his audience along. Remember the question he was asked. By what authority do you do these things? They're asking Jesus, who do you think you are? And then he asked them, he says, so they kill the son, they throw him out of the vineyard here in verse 15. And he asked the crowd, what then do you think the owner of the vineyard will do to them? What do you think? What would you do? What should the owner of the vineyard do? This is good because it helps us remove ourselves from the personal of this situation. Let's just think about the owner of the vineyard for a minute. Let's forget about the fact that we already know that we're the bad guys in the story. And let's just think, objectively, what should the owner of the vineyard do? They've just killed his son. He should get the cops, and he should go take those guys out, right? That's what he should do. That was what would be just. Luke 20:16, Jesus says, he will come, and he will destroy these vine growers, and he will give the vineyard to others. And when the crowd heard this, they cried out, may it never be! Right? They know. They know exactly what Jesus is saying here. He's talking about Israel. He's talking about their rejection of the prophets, their rejection of him. And he's saying to them, God's plan is going to move on from you to somewhere else because you keep killing his representatives and don't recognize his salvation. And they cry out, no, keep sending them. Right? Which is exactly what you and I do. Exactly. We don't see the ridiculousness of our claims to be our own God. Don't take what you've given me away from me just because I don't recognize that it's yours. Allow me to continue in this state of wickedness. And in this false belief that I am my own God, I'm miserable, I'm lonely, I have pains in my heart and wounds that I don't even understand where they came from. I'm not the person that I envisioned myself becoming when I started on this journey. I'm quite sad, I'm quite alone, I'm quite frustrated and confused. Now give me my right to continue in this state. That's the insanity of the human condition without God. That's the way it looks from God's perspective. And he's telling here in the context, the original context of the story, if Israel rejects God's salvation, he will turn to other nations. And that is what happened. There were many Israelites who came to Christ, but the focus of God's saving work in the world spread out to the Roman and Greek world after this. Because they were responsive. In a way that many of the people of Israel were not. And this truth, this understanding was too much for the religious leaders to hear. Just like it's often too much for us to hear. That there is something greater than ourselves and that we need to accept God as our creator and our king. Our master. Our Lord. We have the same problem they did. Who does God think he is? He thinks he's the owner of all things. He thinks he's the father of a murdered son. And he is a merciful spiritual father who, despite all that and despite all of our wickedness, still wants reconciliation with us. Still wants us to become his sons and his daughters. 2 Cor 5, 20 through 21. Therefore, we are ambassadors for Christ, as though God were making an appeal through us. We beg you, on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. He made him who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf, so that we might become the righteousness of God in him. God is not too proud to beg. He loves you so much and wants you to avoid the judgment that you and I deserve. He does not want that for you. And so he sends people into our lives. He sends the Word. He sends his Son. He sends the people in your life here this morning that invited you to come here. He sent the circumstances, whatever they may be, that caused you to walk through this door so that you could get a glimpse, get a picture of what this situation, what your life situation looks like from his perspective. And so that he could beg you to be reconciled to him. He could beg you to stop being your own God and to become his son and his daughter instead. That's his purpose. Israel was destroyed in 70 AD by the Romans. The gospel spread throughout the Greek and Roman world. Yet God has not written Israel or the Jewish people off either. The entire chapter of Romans, chapter 11, is about how God is still working with the Jewish people, that they still have a place in his plan, that they missed this important truth, this important reality, but the gift and the call of God are irrevocable. He made a promise to Abraham, and that promise will be kept. But he will not work only through the Jewish people, because they rejected his son. And so the last 2,000 years have really been more about, from God's perspective, saving those, anyone, and all who would listen. God, he says, will draw all men to himself. Jewish, Gentile, Roman, Greek, Asian, African, whatever you are a creation of God. You are his beloved son, his beloved daughter, and he wants you to come home. He wants you to be connected and united with him in love. And he wants you to get involved and to become a part of his purpose of bringing the light of love and truth and mercy into the dark places of this world. But we have to decide. He will not force you into a relationship with him. We have to decide where we stand with the Creator God of the universe. Jesus then ends this parable in a very interesting way. He quotes Psalm 118, which is a very famous messianic psalm, a psalm that was understood to be about the Messiah. And he says here in Luke 20:17, but Jesus looked at them after they cried out, "May it never be!" He says, "What then is it that is written? What does the Bible say? The stone which the builders rejected, this became the chief cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, but on whomever it falls, it will scatter him like dust." And the scribes and the chief priests tried to lay hands on him that very hour. They're so whipped up into a frenzy about this claim that they're ready to kill him right then and there. But the people were still on his side, and they feared the people because they understood that he had spoken this parable against them. It's a really interesting way that Jesus describes that. See, Jesus is the cornerstone. He's the foundation for God's plan. The first stone laid in a great building, a great temple of God's purposes. And this Messiah, this promised Messiah, it was prophesied hundreds of years before he came. God knew that this Messiah would be rejected. He said, "You set aside the cornerstone, my salvation. You rejected it. You missed it. And now you're in a situation where you either need to throw yourself on Jesus, you need to throw yourself onto the cornerstone, and that will break you. You must be broken before you can throw yourself on Jesus. The act of throwing yourself on the mercy of God will break you to pieces because it requires an understanding, a fundamental base understanding, and that is that you are not God. And that truth breaks us because we're that arrogant. We're that full of ourselves. And few of us would admit that. Few of us would say, well, you know, I'm my own God, you know. Now, but what does it mean to be your own God? It means who decides what's right or wrong? Who prioritizes? Who determines the priorities of your life? Who tells you what to do? Who tells you where to go? Who tells you what love means? Who tells you what forgiveness means? Where do you draw your understanding of these concepts? Well, from my life experience, from my family, the reading I've done, and the people I've interacted with in my many experiences. You are your own God. You're your own God. Because God, the God of the Bible, has very clear explanations of what all of those things are, and they don't match up with us. I love it. I mean, you go out into the world, you talk to me before I became a Christian, you say, what is love? I mean, I'm like, you know, it's like when you think about somebody a lot and you want to be with them. Or, you know, here's my favorite. You have to love yourself before you can love other people. Doesn't that feel good? Yeah. You have to love yourself before you can love other people. My flesh loves that. Because I think about that and I was like, yes! I want to love other people, but I have to be very loved first by me. And then I'll take the leftovers and give it to everybody else. That's what that means, doesn't it? And the thing is it's dead wrong. God says you need to consider the needs of other people as more important than yourself. No, I don't like that. No. Thank you. I'll take the first one. And it's because I'm evil. But God says this, no greater love can a man have than this, than to lay down his life for his friends. That is love. Ask me now what love is. It's self-sacrifice. It's a choice that we make to lift others up, even when they don't deserve it. Where we give of ourselves in order to make others better so that they can have more. That is love. That is God. That is what God has done when He created us. That is what God did when He went to the cross to die for us. And it is what God continues to do as the owner of all things to give us a chance as He pleads with us and begs with us to be reconciled to Him. That is love. And it's something that He can teach us and give us the capacity to give to others, including our children, our spouses, our workers, and our co-neighbors. And it's how the world is going to change. It's how God wants to change the world. So we can fall on Christ and be broken and shattered, which is a very good thing. Or Christ can fall on us, giving us the judgment we deserve and that, in fact, we demand. How can a loving God send people to hell? Why does hell exist? Why is there a God who judges? Because there is deep, broken evil in the world. And God is a righteous and good God. And the people that go to hell are the people who are just like the tenants in the vineyard, who continue throughout their lives, despite all the people and all the ways that God begs them to lay down their arms and come into a relationship with Him, who demand, no, I will not be broken. I will not accept that I am yours. I am my own God. And if there is judgment that I deserve, I will pay for it myself. Thank you very much. I demand to pay for my own sin. I'll stand up and take whatever it is. I remember saying that. I'm so glad that God didn't quit on me when I was in that foolish place. Because what we deserve is eternal judgment. Eternal separation from God Himself. And it's why He's so desperate. It's why He pursued me with so many people over so many years in so many ways to help me change my mind. And it's why he pursues you. It's why you're here this morning. This is just the latest act, the latest effort on his part to bring you into an understanding of his heart for you. What this is not meant to scare us into becoming Christians. God's way smarter than that. He knows, like, if he holds a gun to our head and says, believe in me and love me, you know, that we'll never do it. No one would ever do that. The threat of hell is so that we can understand that God is just. If the vineyard owner never comes to bring judgment upon these tenants, what kind of a pansy is he? He just sits back and is like, kill my servants, kill my son, take my stuff, just, you know, don't hurt me. Like, what kind of a God would that be? What kind of a fool? What kind of a weakling would that be? No, the judgment of God is there because God is not weak, and he is righteous, and he demands that evil be punished. But it is not there as a threat to try to create love in our hearts for him. The part that creates the love in our hearts for him is knowing how much and how far he will go to try to help us avoid that judgment that we deserve. That's the God of the Bible. Der Bach, one of my favorite commentators on Luke and Acts, puts it this way. God's judgment is not capricious. It is rather the culmination of a long process. He rejects people only after a long effort to try and gain a response from them. Jesus wept as he entered Jerusalem because judgment is not what God desires to bring on humankind. Judgment comes only because we fail to respond to God's compassion. I don't know about you, but this story, I get why they wanted to kill Jesus now. I get it. He was telling them this truth. If you're there, sitting in your chair there, and you're thinking, you know, about what a jerk I am, and how this is all foolish and offensive, and you're feeling anger in your heart, let me just say, we understand. We understand how hard it is to hear that you're not God. And that audience understood. Those religious rulers, they wanted to be in control. They wanted their way. And they were willing to kill Jesus for threatening their system. It didn't matter whether it was true or not. It didn't matter whether it was good or not. It was not what they wanted, and it was a threat to the godhood of their own life. Let me just plead with you one more time for something else. John 1, 9 through 13, there was the light, the true light, which coming into the world enlightens every man. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. He came to his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. But as many as did receive him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believe in his name. Who were born not of blood, nor the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. You can be reconciled to God. All you need to do is say, I understand that Jesus died for my sin, and that you are God, and that I am not. Will you forgive me and come into my life? We beg you to do this, to have the eyes of your heart open, and to see the world for what it really is, which is God's world. And to take your place as God's son or God's daughter in his mission to bring his love and his truth into the world. Who are the servants that God has sent into your life? Over and over and over again. You are his vineyard, and he has sent people over and over and over again into your life. You know he has. To say, are you ready? Are you ready to accept that you're not the owner, that you're not God? And how do you treat them? How accurate of an explanation is this for you? I had a lot of people I had to go back to. after I became a Christian, I had to thank a lot of people who I thought were real jerks because they kept pestering me about this Jesus thing. And I'm so glad that they did. And I'm so ashamed of the way that I treated those people, those representatives of God, who in their own ways were fallen and imperfect and sometimes weird. But they were gods. And they were willing. They were willing to listen to him. They were willing to answer his call to take me on and get into an unpleasant conversation. And I'm so grateful to them for that. And I'm so grateful to God for that. So what we can do is we can see that we are God's vineyard and acknowledge his right to lead us as our God. That's the heart of what we're asking, of what we're pleading for you this morning. But the other aspect of this is important too. Jesus knew he would be making enemies, but he believed this truth was more important than his popularity or his security. He has come to die. He knows where he's headed. He knows that all the people that were crying, Hosanna, Hosanna, you know, the king is here, are going to be yelling, crucify, crucify, crucify in 6 days. And he was willing to do it, and he was willing to die, and he was willing to go to that cross because this truth is so important. It's important enough for us to take risks in our relationships too. It's important enough for us to take risks at work, risks with our neighbors, and to potentially sacrifice our popularity and security with them. It's that important. It is the key to eternal life and for understanding love, for what love really is, which is God's love. And then the most amazing thing is we do, in fact, inherit the vineyard because we do, in fact, become heirs and sons and daughters of the King of the universe. He actually does, the father of a murdered son, invite us into his family and make us heirs of eternity with him. That's, I think, the human condition from God's perspective.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.